Welcome to The Week Ahead in Russia, a Radio Free Europe podcast on developments in Russia, its war against Ukraine, and its relations with the rest of the world. I'm Steve Gutterman, editor for Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus in the Central Newsroom at RFERL, and author of The Week in Russia newsletter. This week's podcast is about the shakeup of Russia's military and security leadership, with longtime defense minister Sergei Shoigu replaced by Andrei Belousov, an economist with no military background, and close Putin ally Nikolai Patrushev replaced by Shoigu as secretary of the Presidential Security Council. We'll also discuss Russia's new offensive in the Kharkiv region of Ukraine and the May 9th Victory Day ceremonies, another platform for Putin to lash out against the West. And my guest today on The Week Ahead in Russia is Mark Galliotti, an analyst of Russian politics, honorary professor at the UCL School of Slavonic and East European Studies in London, and the author of several books, including We Need to Talk About Putin, The Weaponization of Everything, and Putin's Wars from Chechnya to Ukraine. Thanks very much for joining me, Mark.
Always a pleasure.
All right. The pleasure is mine. Great to have you on the show again. A bit of a Sunday night surprise from Putin last night, just when some of us thought there might not be any major personnel changes following his inauguration to a fifth term in the Kremlin last week. Putin dismissed Sergei Shoigu, his defense minister since 2012, and moved him to the top post in the Security Council, an advisory body that is quite prominent. And that means Nikolai Patrushev, who had been the secretary of the Security Council, is out. And Putin's spokesman said Patrushev's new position will be announced in the coming days. So that's a loose end at this point. Now, in Shoigu's place, Putin proposed Andrei Belousov as defense minister, and these changes are sure to be approved by the upper parliament house in the next day or two. Belousov has held economic roles in the government or in Putin's administration since shortly after Putin came to power in 2000, and in fact quite senior roles, although advisory in some cases, since 2012 when he was named economic development minister. He even served as acting prime minister for a few weeks in 2020. Mark, we can follow up with some details, but I'm going to try to keep the main question simple here and ask about motives. Why has Putin made this change, and why now?
Well, I mean, I think Shoigu's position was becoming somewhat untenable. I say somewhat because ultimately Putin can keep whoever he wants where he wants them. But nonetheless, the arrest last month of Deputy Defense Minister Timur Ivanov, who was not just a close crony of Shoigu's, but also probably the so-called wallet holding some of his ill-gotten corrupt earnings. Let's be honest, no senior Russian official lives by their salary alone. Also was a sign that probably Shoigu was on his way out. He's monstrously unpopular with the troops and hasn't proven to be a particularly effective wartime Minister of Defense. But on the other hand, Shoigu is a friend, a personal friend of Putin's, and Putin's strangely loyal to his own, and also still a very highly rated and highly competent political operator. So in some ways it was likely he was going to go, but this is it, not so much dismissed, but precisely moved. The fact that Belousov, and this is quite a surprise, was appointed as his replacement, I think very much speaks to the fact that Putin is aware that this war is not likely to be going anywhere anytime soon. As he digs in for the long term, and we see this in his rhetoric, but also we're now seeing it within the government apparatus, from his point of view, this is a war that is going to be won to a large extent on industrial production. And this is why Belousov comes in. I mean, he is a highly able economist. He knows his way around the government system well by being involved in it for so long. He's worked with Putin. Putin trusts him. And he is, unlike so many of the economic technocrats, I wouldn't say a hardliner, but certainly a nationalist and above all a statist. He's long been of the view that, in fact, the state should have a greater role in controlling the economy. And that's exactly what's already happening and what will continue to happen. So basically, if you want someone to build a wartime military supporting economy, then Belousov's a good choice. And from that point of view, again, some people have said, oh, Putin has appointed a man with no military experience. Almost every defense minister has no military experience in recent years, just as, frankly, in the West, they don't tend to. In wartime circumstances, and or in, as it turns out, in special military operation circumstances, actually the role of the Minister of Defense is not to manage the war effort. His job is not to determine strategy and to apportion the troops and determine operational procedures and so forth. That's the chief of the general staff under orders directly from the commander-in-chief, in other words, Putin. The job of the defense minister is precisely to actually provide the wherewithal so that the military can do their job. So I think very much it's an economic administration role as well as a political role. And therefore, I think Belousov fits. So what this sort of says is actually a kind of a sorting out of the system. Shoigu was actually a very effective peacetime defense minister in that he did manage to bring around a lot of reorganizations and he just managed to hype the role of the military a lot. Shoigu is good at PR. Those same arts did not work in wartime. So it's time for him to move on and someone else to come in. So I think that's the sort of the motivation from the point of view of the defense ministry. The other point, though, is exactly about Shoigu moving to the Security Council. The Security Council itself is not that important a body. It's got a lot of important people on it. The council is attended by all the key figures who are involved with security matters, very broadly conceived, as well as people like Moscow Mayor Sobyanin. But it's not a decision-making body. As you said, it's not even advisory in some ways. It's more where decisions are promulgated and particular interdepartmental disputes resolved. The really important bit of the security apparatus is the secretariat, which under Nikolai Patrushev's 17-year tenure has become not just the key body whereby almost all security matters sort of get funneled so that, whether it's briefing documents for Putin's desk or decision-making about all kinds of apportionments of responsibilities, it goes through the secretariat. And in that role, what happened was that Nikolai Patrushev essentially de facto took over two positions which the Russian system doesn't have: National Security Advisor and Director of National Intelligence. So although constitutionally the Secretary of the Security Council has almost no real power, in practice, Patrushev became crucial not just in painting a picture of the outside world for Putin, but also in channeling intelligence materials his way. And that's actually been a real problem, because in some ways the job of the National Security Advisor is precisely to be the independent figure who owes responsibility only to the president, and who in part he or she is meant to be there to fact check the spooks, to be actually to say, I think they're trying to guide you here, or they're working off incomplete intelligence or whatever. When you have these two roles put together, especially from someone with a KGB background, actually, he became more of an advocate for and cheerleader for the spooks. And clearly, given that Patrushev was extraordinarily hawkish, he continued to push Putin in that direction. So it's going to be very interesting to see if Shoigu can maintain the same kind of power. I suspect he won't be as powerful as before, but also how he uses it, if at all.
All right. Thanks very much for that, Mark. I guess I have a follow-up question about Patrushev. I think you mentioned on your own presentation, and you mentioned just now that he kind of is, I don't know, I guess it's maybe more hawkish than Putin. I mean, I've always wondered, I guess, how much is he influencing Putin? And of course, he comes out with these conspiracy theories. He seems to believe these kinds of things more perhaps than Putin does. I'm digressing, but the question is essentially, is this going to, and I guess it's hard to say since we don't know where he's going, how close he'll be to Putin, whether he'll kind of have his ear still, but is this likely to lead to some kind of a change in Putin's perception? And could that be significant?
I wouldn't want to overplay it. I mean, I think it is clear that absolutely Patrushev is indeed more hawkish than Putin himself. Putin believes a lot of nonsense, but particularly the nonsense that Putin believes in is usually vested in the historical assessments he gives about, you know, Ukraine's non-existence and all that kind of thing. It is clear that Patrushev has exercised, especially in recent years, an increasingly baleful influence on Putin, pushing this idea of the West as being this sort of hostile conspiratorial force, which is something that Putin himself believed and believes. But just how far you believe that there are these sort of deep-rooted plans that somehow managed to never get revealed but still have survived from presidency to presidency in the United States to dismember the Russian Federation or whatever. You know, these are the sort of things that Patrushev absolutely seems to believe and certainly has been for years dripping this poison in Putin's ear. The interesting thing, of course, is that Patrushev is very close to Putin in the sense that Putin clearly trusts him. Patrushev has, you know, more face time, frankly, with the president, even than Prime Minister Mishustin. But he's not a friend, as near as I can tell, in the sense of there's very little evidence of the two men socializing in a way that, you know, Shoigu, he takes, or certainly took, Putin hiking in his native Siberia. He skates on Putin's ice hockey team, that kind of thing. They do socialize. So Patrushev, it'll be interesting to see when he doesn't have, shall I say, an institutional excuse to be in constant contact with the president, whether he actually does maintain that same degree of contact. Because the interesting thing is also about Shoigu. Shoigu is, I would say, neither a hawk nor a dove. They are fairly persistent and moderately persuasive views that actually Shoigu was opposed to the 2014 annexation of Crimea and may well also have had reservations about the 2022 invasion of Ukraine. But of course, he's ultimately a politician and a kleptocrat. He's not the sort of person who's actually going to stand out and say, no, I cannot go along with this or whatever. So, you know, he did what he needed to do. Now, in that context, we're in an almost kind of Hippocratic first do no harm situation, in that I do not imagine that Shoigu is going to be someone who will be articulating any kind of de-escalation or withdrawal from the conflict, because he knows that that is not what Putin wants to hear. But on the other hand, nor do I necessarily feel that Shoigu will be articulating a view that says there needs to be an escalation, that in fact NATO is just waiting for the opportunity to pounce, or whatever nonsense Patrushev may well be saying today and could have said tomorrow. So I think in this context, in some ways, Shoigu is a neutral presence that at least isn't making things worse. But it also means that should circumstances arise that mean that the balance of opinion within Putin's circle begins to shift to some negotiation. And look, again, it won't be for any good moral reasons. It'll just be because that's seen as pragmatic. I think Shoigu would be much more able to manage that kind of a pivot. It's very hard to see under any circumstances that Patrushev could have been talking peace, even for the most pragmatic reasons. So I'm not expecting any improvement in the situation for the moment, but in some ways, at least it means that potentially, and that's all it can be say, potentially, especially if Patrushev does begin to drift away from Putin's circle, then at least it means things might not, hard to believe that they could, but things might not get any worse.
Okay, thanks, Mark. And I guess, so Patrushev's kind of future role is a loose end. And another thing that I think some people are saying is still uncertain is the situation with the chief of the general staff, Valery Gerasimov. He remains, for now, at least, and I think Putin's spokesman Peskov said words to that effect. He remains for the time being. But I think there's some speculation or maybe informed speculation that he may also be on his way out once Belousov gets settled into the defense minister position. I mean, obviously, Gerasimov and Shoigu were sort of both together at the time of Prigozhin's mutiny, and through the since the full-scale invasion of Ukraine. So I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on that.
Yeah, look, it's normally the case that a new defense minister will bring in a new chief of the general staff. They're going to want their own top soldier. We had, obviously, Shoigu with Gerasimov, before him, Serdyukov and Makarov. You know, there is definitely that sense that there needs to be a team. And Gerasimov, it has to be said, has proven to be a massively underperforming and unpopular chief of the general staff. I mean, he's even more despised amongst his own men than Shoigu was, which is quite a high bar to vault. So I think in this respect, I would suspect that precisely once Belousov has been in place for a little while, because I wouldn't be surprised if this appointment came as a rather surprise, something of a surprise to him as well. But once he's had a chance to identify potential candidates, I wouldn't be surprised if we see a new chief of the general staff. And that might well be, like so many of these appointments, actually bad news for Ukraine. Just as Belousov may well prove to be a rather more effective manager of military assets and may well also be tasked with cracking down on the corruption that continues to bleed defense spending, well, so too a new chief of the general staff might actually be, well, I wouldn't say might be a better one, would be hard-pressed to be any worse than Gerasimov. We have figures like General Kiplinsky, who's head of the airborne troops, or even General Armageddon, though I'm not really convinced if that actually is more than just a media myth, that title. But anyway, General Surovikin, who had been rusticated after the suggestions of his support for Yevgeny Prigozhin's mutiny last year, but is still on the bench and could conceivably come back. So, I mean, I think we are likely to see a new chief of the general staff, and much will depend on quite who that is. But from the Ukrainians' point of view, after all, in some ways, Shoigu and Gerasimov was a bit of a dream team. But also, you can just pick up on the other loose end that you mentioned, Patrushev. Because again, I've been trying to kind of rack my brains as to what will be a suitable position for him. Because the very fact that they said there's a new job suggests not just that he's not going to be retiring, even though he's 72, but presumably also means that he's not going to be shuffled off to a seat on the Senate or something, which is a classic honorific semi-retirement. Prime Minister would have been an obvious position if he was still in favour, but we now know no, Mishustin is still Prime Minister. It's hard to see another position that would seem to fit Patrushev's skills and actually work. I mean, not even head of the presidential administration, though that is still a possibility. I do wonder if Putin is actually going to create a new position for him. And it may well be one of those two that he had de facto been filling: National Security Advisor or Director of National Intelligence, probably with the latter being a little bit more likely. And again, unfortunately, in either of those cases, that means that the Patrushev factor would still be in play. He would still have ample access to the president. He would still have a powerful institutional voice in not just shaping security policy, but in many ways presenting the picture to Putin of what the outside world is like and what the options are at his disposal. So, you know, although I mean, having in the past described Patrushev as the most dangerous man in Russia, I would be delighted to see him moving away from the center of power, but I wouldn't yet be popping the champagne corks yet.
All right, absolutely. So we'll be watching that, of course. Now, this shakeup is occurring amid a new development in Russia's war against Ukraine. It began unfolding late last week when Russian forces pushed, I guess, across the border into the Kharkiv region and claimed to have taken, I believe, initially 5 villages. They were claiming very close to the border. And now I believe they are claiming to have taken some more territory, and there are evacuations going on in the area. Now, just a geographical note, this is an area to the northeast of the city of Kharkiv, which is Ukraine's second largest and is quite close to the Russian border. And it's pretty far north of the parts of the Kharkiv and Donetsk regions where there's been major fighting in recent weeks and months. Military experts seem to be saying there's little chance that Russian forces could take the city of Kharkiv, which they've been pounding with bombardments for weeks now. And that Moscow's main goal with this new offensive may be to spread Ukrainian forces thin by drawing some away from other hotspots on the front line further south in the Donbass and then southwest in Zaporizhia, Kherson regions. And this comes at a time when Ukraine is struggling with manpower problems and firepower problems, as new U.S. weapons supplies were held up for 6 months before an aid package was finally approved by Congress in April. Mark, what do you think about this push in the Kharkiv region? What's Russia's objective, and how big a deal might it be?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with the consensus, however boring that may sound, that on the whole, this is not actually a serious attempt to try and take Kharkiv. Ironically enough, if the Russians really wanted to do that, they would actually have to be transferring troops of their own from the other various fronts, which would mean, well, not only would their advances there probably stall, but they may well actually lose territory that they've taken. So, and unless they're willing to do that, given that they haven't gone through, for example, the mobilization that many generals actually had wanted Putin to do, but he decided not to do so, probably for political reasons, they haven't really got the troops precisely to take Kharkiv. What they can do, though, is exactly as you said. First of all, try and divert scarce Ukrainian resources away from those other fronts so that they can try and make headway there. Secondly, they can try and bring Kharkiv within artillery range. I mean, if they continue to push forward, they don't have to get to Kharkiv to basically be able to start pounding Kharkiv with artillery. Up to now, it's been glide bombs, missiles, and drones that they have kept a fairly continuous bombardment of Kharkiv on. Well, if they can also move artillery into that range, then they actually have even more chances of making Kharkiv's life very miserable indeed. And why might they want to do that? Well, something that I think is sometimes neglected here is the political dimension. At the moment, Belgorod, the neighboring Russian region, is getting a regular pounding from the Ukrainians. Recently, for example, that there was an apartment building in Belgorod that was badly hit. And I think this is also part of a political campaign to try and reassure the people of Belgorod, we haven't entirely forgotten you, we haven't neglected you, we're not actually ignoring your plight. We're now going to try and create a cordon sanitaire that will actually minimize the Ukrainians' opportunities to reach you. Now, in practice, moving 5, 10, 20, 50 kilometers into Ukraine is not going to stop the Ukrainians from being able to launch attacks on Belgorod. I mean, considering that their drones are ranging very far afield these days. But the point is, again, I think there is an element of symbolism here, that there was a growing anger, frankly, to the north of Ukraine, border regions that were actually being hit and were feeling that Moscow was just neglecting them. So I think there's an element of this. So I think, for all of these reasons, this is not a crucial battlefield in the sense of it's not about to lead to a major Russian victory. They're not, as you say, going to take Kharkiv. But on the other hand, as a force multiplier, as something that, if it, as it is already doing, draws Ukrainian troops away, Ukrainian troops that are frankly not just suffering from ammunition hunger, but also soldier hunger. If they can do that, then they have a better chance of being able to advance on the fronts that really matter to them, which is again essentially pushing out from Luhansk and Donetsk regions.
All right, thanks. And yeah, I can see what you're saying about kind of the partly the target audience of this being in Russia and in the Belgorod region. These forces are coming from the Belgorod region, and I guess if Russia takes more territory, then the kind of red zone on the map shifts away from the border with Belgorod. Though, as you say, most of the attacks there, are also from drones and good point that this won't diminish Ukraine's ability to strike in the Belgorod region very much. But let's turn from the ongoing war to World War II, or more accurately, to Russia's commemoration of that war. I mean, it's really kind of surreal to me. This is the third year, though, that Putin's presided over a military parade on Red Square, commemorating World War II and the victory in World War II over the Nazis, while the biggest war in Europe since World War II is going on and was caused by Russia in Ukraine. But he does this every year on May 9th. Pretty predictable stuff, and Putin predictably used the parade speech to criticize the West. One notable thing I would mention is the fact that several officers from units accused of committing atrocities in Ukraine, Bucha and elsewhere, were sitting near Putin on Red Square. And Putin, of course, is himself wanted by the International Criminal Court on suspicion of war crimes for the illegal transfer of children from Ukraine to Russia. But Mark, I mean, this is kind of a wartime celebration of war. What was your impression of the Russian ceremonies this year? Did anything jump out at you as meaningful?
The only really surprising thing about the whole day was the fact that it snowed. First time that people can remember that happening, especially because usually the Russians seed the clouds to make sure that it's always a bright sunny day for Victory Day. Because the actual event itself was stultifyingly predictable. I was even expecting or hoping or anticipating some kind of new rhetorical twist in Putin's speech, some new way of framing this, as puts it, grand existential political struggle with NATO that is being played out in Ukraine, but also elsewhere in different ways. But actually, we got something that, frankly, if you put ChatGPT into just simply creating a digest of Putin's speeches, probably would have come out with what Putin said. Likewise, the parade itself. They still had just a single World War II vintage T-34 tank standing in for the entire sort of tank forces. There was nothing really that sprung out. And I think that's important precisely because I think it shows that really Putin doesn't have anything more to say. He doesn't have anything new to say. He's dug into his rhetorical, political, as well as metaphorical bunker, and that's where he's going to stay until either he's found some kind of a victory or circumstances force him to change his policies again. And in that context, talking about the presence of people who have been alleged to have connections with war crimes, again, I think what this reflects is a degree to which, again, going back to this metaphor of digging in, that under Putin or Putin's state, has come to internalize its position as a pariah in the eyes of the West and the institutions that the West created and sort of upholds, just as with sanctions, so too with war crimes or claims. Given that, remember, they're now talking about the global South, for example, as the world majority, there is very much that sense of no, this is not what the world is. What the West has its own little kind of institutions. The world is something different. I think this is just basically Russia saying, fine, we have had enough. We don't care. We don't care about what you say about us. We don't care about whether you take out an arrest warrant against us. You can have your sanctions. You can have whatever. We oppose you and all of your institutions and claims. And therefore, I think the presence of these people was therefore at once a symbolic two-fingered gesture at the West, but also a sign, actually, again, within Russia, to say, don't worry. If you're concerned about how your actions are going to be perceived by the West, don't worry. We will protect you, we will elevate you, and we will certainly not throw you to the wolves. So again, just as with, for example, the reshuffle within the security apparatus, to me, what this says is, clear realization on the part of Putin and the state system that not only is the war itself in Ukraine likely to continue for some time, but the wider political, economic, cultural, social, legal conflict with the West is also not likely to go away. And in some ways, therefore, the state has to be built to operate in those kind of circumstances. This is almost a, and I don't want to overplay it, but one could almost call this a certain sort of North Koreanization of Russia.
All right. Well, on that note, let's wrap it up.
A very positive note, yes.
Certainly a change from the times when Western leaders used to sometimes attend the parade. It's hard to kind of fathom. But we'll wrap it up here, and thanks very much for joining me, Mark.
Always a pleasure.
All right, the pleasure is mine. Once again, I've been speaking to Mark Galeotti, an analyst of Russian politics, honorary professor at the UCL School of Slavonic and East European Studies in London, and the author of several books, including We Need to Talk About Putin, The Weaponization of Everything, and Putin's Wars from Chechnya to Ukraine. And my name is Steve Gutterman, editor for Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus in the Central Newsroom at RFERL. This has been The Week Ahead in Russia. Our theme music is Не стреляй, or Don't Shoot, a song from the early 1980s by Yuri Shevchuk and DDT. Please be sure to check out my newsletter, The Week in Russia, which covers the latest developments in Russian politics and society, as well as Moscow's invasion of Ukraine. Subscribe by visiting www.rferl.org.